The Circling Podcast is proud to be in partnership with Bend Magazine. Claim your $5 annual subscription when you visit bendmagazine.com and enter promo code PODCAST at checkout. Your subscription includes 6 issues of our region's top publication celebrating mountain culture and 4 bonus issues of Bend Home and Design, the leading home and building design magazine in Central Oregon. Remember, enter promo code PODCAST at checkout. On episode 13, I'm joined by Dr. Derek Abbey, President and CEO of Project Recover. Project Recover is a collaborative partnership using 21st century science and technology in a quest to find and repatriate Americans missing in action since World War II. The amazing work that Derek and his team are doing provides recognition and closure for families of those who gave the ultimate sacrifice. Project Recover recently released To What Remains, a stirring feature-length documentary that follows Project Recover's search for more than 80,000 Americans missing in action since World War II. To What Remains is screening at the Tower Theater on January 20th and available online. Prior to joining Project Recover, Derek served in the United States Marine Corps, first as an enlisted Marine and ultimately as an F-18 fighter pilot. Derek ended his unique military career as one of the original members of the Marine Forces Special Operations Command, known as MARSOC. Having obtained his PhD in leadership and described as artful in his leadership style, Derek and his team continue to expand the efforts of Project Recover globally, keeping the promise America has made to her missing service members. Thanks for your time, Derek. You're a hell of an individual, and it was an absolute pleasure getting to talk with you. I learned about your story growing up in Seattle, you know, unfortunately having a mom that passed away when you were very young.
Yeah.
Getting raised with your aunt and uncle. Was that your mom's?
Yeah, my mom's sister.
Sister?
Yeah.
Do they still live in Seattle?
They live, it's south, so they live in on the outskirts of Tacoma, so okay. SeaTac area, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Did they have, one question I had for you is, did they have kids?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had 2 cousins, an older, okay. 1 year older boy and a 1 year younger girl.
Yeah. So you were around 13
yep,
when that happened?
Yeah, I was 13, yep.
So that's I have a 13-year-old daughter.
Wow.
Which... I was thinking about this the other day. Sounds young, and is.
Yeah.
But when you look at, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, you know, when you're well over halfway
yeah.
over your time in your life with your parents, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the, like, just nurturing that's gone on
yeah.
has happened. There's still a lot left, for
yeah.
sure. But it's crazy how quick it goes.
Well, and then... And I don't know if you want to say this for the podcast, but when I think about that, when I reflect on that, yeah, it is kind of half of your life to your adulthood, but it's not a lot of your memory.
Exactly.
So when you think about it, like, when do you really get memories? You know, you start having memories like 5 or 6,
right.
or, you know, little snippets before that. But so my memory with my mom, that's something that I'm always like, I don't really have a lot,
yeah.
you know, and then I don't have a lot of things,
right?
Like I don't have much that, reminds me of her.
Yeah.
I have a few pictures and a few little artifacts, but that's it.
Yeah.
So
is that something, and obviously, you know, I mean, go into this to the level of your mm-hmm. comfort, but is that,
I'm very comfortable with it actually. So
yeah,
it took me a long time to get to there. So
that's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
Tell me about that process just a lot of,
The process was an enormous amount of pain,
yeah.
you know, and anger and, you know, abandonment issues and all that. And then I was well into my 20s before I could even go through a conversation about it. And then probably my late 30s, maybe even 40s, before I could really kind of articulate learning points from it, where I took some time and I went back and really reflected on, you know, what are the things that I'm holding on to? What are the things I need to process that I haven't processed? Those types of things, so that I could move forward in a positive way, if you will, and, you know, use them to, I guess I can't say just improve my life, because there were elements of it that improved my life. So I became very, very self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Very, very young.
Yeah.
Didn't depend on anybody, but the problem was it had a shadow to it.
Yeah. Everything comes at a cost.
Yeah. So, it took me until way, way adulthood to realize that, oh, there's a shadow here that you also have to pay attention to. And, you know, that was in the form of like being afraid of committing to a relationship fully or abandonment issues and things like that. And so, once I took the time and kind of looked back at that and realized the shadows of it and how I needed to move forward in a better way, then I made myself available to be in the best relationships of my life.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that funny, my wife and I are,
are an incredible marriage now that, is very, very positive. And, we have, you know, our own identities, but we have our collective identity, and, but it took a long time to get there, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm a big advocate for counseling of some sort or another. Mm-hmm. I think if more people went on a regular basis, the world would be a better place.
Yeah, you know? And that wasn't, I mean, as a 13-year-old and everybody dealing with her, that's just like
Only recently I would say that, you know, therapy is something that people are more comfortable talking about openly and saying that they go do, you know,
and that's what I did. I went to a counselor and it didn't take a whole lot, but, the process of kind of putting it out in front of me and looking at it, the subject object thing, where you take a moment to separate it from yourself and examine it, was what really allowed me to kind of move forward in a positive way.
I bet you anything, the way your mind was trained to operate, whether being in the military or not, just with, maybe not, but taking some emotional, aspects out of that and just looking at things for what they are. I bet it was helpful for someone just to kind of show you how to do that. And then I bet you started putting a lot of the pieces together on your own.
I did. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I started kind of consuming a lot of literature around it and then examining my life and figuring out how to move forward in the best way possible. And, and you know, it's funny, you mentioned the military, but the things that, kind of I struggled with in childhood, when I look back at my military career, they were the things that made me a successful Marine, like the ability to compartmentalize and things like that, you know, take the emotion out of it and just focus on the task.
Yeah.
Helped me a lot in that process. But again, at some point you got to go back and take those things off the shelf and take a look at them.
I'm, you know, before we started recording this, we were talking about how we both are avid audiobook listeners. Just finished listening to The Comfort Crisis that you had recommended.
Yeah.
It's a solid book, man.
I love it.
That's one of those where I listen to it and now I'm going to order an actual copy of it.
I do that often.
Because I think it'll be worth having in the library. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love audiobooks, but then I, when I read books, I take notes.
Yeah.
So if I ever give you a book, it probably has a bunch of my notes in it or highlighted sections and things like that. And, you know, or they'll reference something or mention something and I'm like, oh, I want to go learn more about that.
Absolutely.
I was scribbling all over The Comfort Crisis and I love that book. And I think it's very, very valuable for people to read today.
I agree. I was, thinking about how to start talking with you because, as we mentioned earlier, there's a couple other podcasts that you've recorded that do a really good job about kind of laying out your story personally and then professionally and your current role as the president and CEO of Project Recover. But I wanted to kind of allow our conversation maybe for people to get to know you better.
Yeah. Yeah.
One question I wanted to ask
you. I think we're off to a good start.
Yeah, that's true. What are some values that you would use to describe yourself?
Yeah. My values are, they kind of look like circles, right? The immediate circles around me.
Yeah.
to include myself. So personal health is very important to me. And that's something that I'm spending a lot of time as we're at the beginning of 2022, examining. And the reason is like, not just like, oh, I want to be the healthiest person that I can be, but I think I need to be the best instrument that I can be to have a positive impact on the other things around me. So personal health and well-being is important to me, and all the factors included in that. And the reason that that's important is it just being the best instrument and the best husband that I can be, the mm-hmm. best father that I can be, the best citizen and community member and things like that. And then it moves out from there. So family is important to me. Those intimate relationships, and I don't have very many of them. I have my wife, and our collective, family, which is really just us. Mm-hmm. You know, my son is grown from my first marriage. Now he lives in Boston, but, he's also part of that circle. And then it moves out to, the community around me and having a positive impact on the community and in whatever capacity that I can. And through that, I've developed this personal mission statement that includes, you know, having a positive impact on as many people throughout my lifetime as possible. And we kind of touched on it a little bit where it's not necessarily, it has to be in this area, or that area or a specific area. Really, I've kept myself open to kind of whatever doors, windows, portals presented themselves. And if I feel like my voice, has an impact in that space, then I'll put more and more energy into that. And really that's the basis of my values. It's not money,
right?
It's not things like that. It's not possessions or anything like that. It's these intangible relationships. And I mean, health, you can measure, you know, you can tell if a relationship is there or not, and you can probably tell if it's healthy or not. But, so I pay attention to that. And then I look at my time, energy, money, and things like that. And I examine whether, you know, my espoused values align with my practice values. And we drift all the time because we're human, and we get distracted, or we get tired, or we get bored, or whatever.
You just said it, distraction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find yourself getting distracted?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Especially when you get fatigued and things like that, you know, work avoidance creeps up and we can find ourselves. I mean, today it's like social media or media in general or other things are a distraction compared to the task at hand.
Yeah.
So I try not to do that, but at least I can become conscious of it and then self-correct, hopefully, or if somebody else points it out, you know, be gracious that they did that. And then
that was a point I came to in that book, The Comfort Crisis, which was oftentimes our distractions, I think, come from not wanting or not being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that could be, you know, the discomfort associated with having to put together a presentation and wanting to just kind of punt it down the road a little bit it's a really interesting concept that I think, you know, to kind of quote that author, you know, we've the majority of us have kind of possibly become victim to the success of our species.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
And I mean, maybe I was just naive, but I haven't really been thinking about that as much as I have in the last few weeks. And it's a big deal.
It is. Well, when we live these luxuries, for lack of a better statement, it makes us soft.
Oh, right? My gosh.
And so one of the things I thought was incredible from that book was, and I spent a lot of time thinking about it and still do, is our inability to be comfortable being bored.
Totally.
And I think back when I was a kid, I was bored all the time. And then if you're not comfortable with it, or the instant you become bored, you pick up your phone and you start scrolling through Instagram or Facebook or some other social media, well, then you miss out on potential creativity and things like that. And so, I mean, now I've become far more conscious of it. And when I just feel, oh, I'm actually bored right now, instead of turning on the TV or reaching for my phone, I try and take a moment to first acknowledge it and then just kind of, what can I think about or what can I do that could be productive in this time? And maybe that's writing, or maybe it's just thinking about a project you need to work on. And, you know, those are the moments when that creativity really comes and presents itself, where you have those moments to just have time with your thoughts and process things, you know. And then I thought back on those moments when, you know, we talk about it all the time, but when you're in the shower and you're like, oh, I have an idea.
For sure.
Well, you're not distracted by anything except for probably cleaning yourself or enjoying the hot water if you have it, or if it's cold water, getting out quick, or when I'm on a run or something like that. You know, I don't run with headphones anymore. I try and go out.
I go back and forth on that one.
If I'm in town, I will, which I don't really run in town too often, but if I'm out in nature, I really just try and enjoy nature. If I'm in town, I might listen to an audiobook or some music or things like that. But rarely do I wear headphones anymore. I just really try and experience the moment. But that's part of it, where it's like we've created these things that kind of distract us from boredom or discomfort. Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, I'm discomfortable. I'm uncomfortable because I'm punishing myself on this run, or I'm tired or something. So I'm going to put on music as a distraction. Or
And when I say discomfort, I think in my mind, you always think about, you know, discomfort for me anyways is more of a physical experience. When I'm starting to think that maybe the more dangerous, is more of a mental discomfort. And not, and sitting in that, people don't like that.
No,
and
we bring up distractions.
Yeah, because most of the most tangible distractions nowadays for me are not because of I want to replace a physical discomfort. Mm-hmm. It's I want to replace some sort of mental discomfort where I'm either don't agree with that or worried that if that is true, what's that going to actually mean to me, you know, and my belief systems. And it just, and so what do? We get exactly what we want to hear when we want to hear it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all to fill a void of, possibly some mental discomfort that looks like might be good for you to sit in for a minute.
Yeah. Well, and you were talking about the confirmation, right? So, and that's what social media does.
Right.
All the algorithms just continue to tell you what you want to hear, and you seek out what you want to hear, and then it tells you, and you just create this loop that doesn't challenge anything. It only, you don't go into cognitive dissonance at all.
No.
All it does is confirm whether those ideas are good or bad, which is a little dangerous.
Yeah. It's interesting stuff, man. We're gonna have to carry this on.
Hey, this might be my favorite conversation on a podcast. This is good stuff.
that means a lot coming from you, my friend. All right. So I know not everybody is gonna be familiar with you from previous media exposure you've had. So I thought maybe we could do let's just start talking about kind of your life after growing up. You graduated high school in Washington, and then as I understand, you joined the Marine Corps because you seemed to have the maturity at that point to know that maybe this would be good for me.
Wow, that's a lot of credit. That's probably too much credit.
Well, I mean,
no,
it seems
I ran away
with what you've done in life.
But no, at that time,
you're ahead of the curve on stuff.
My life was a disaster, and I ran away to the Marine Corps. I was looking for some sort of escape, and the military was an out. And so I kind of picked the service that, you know, I assessed, and the Marine Corps seems the hardest. They got the best uniforms or whatever, you
they
know.
They do have solid uniforms.
all the wrong reasons, but that's what I did. And I found exactly what I needed, you know. The way I tell the story is I didn't have a rudder or a sail, and I needed a system that I could succeed in that provided some stability. And the Marine Corps definitely did that, you know, stability and discipline and a system that I could succeed in. The military, you know, they tell you what you need to do, or they write down what you need to do. And as long as you do that to the standards that they set, you're going to have a successful career in the military. And especially the lower ranks. And so, you know, I enlisted, I was, you know, private PFC, Lance Corporal Abbey. And
what year did you enlist? What year?
1991.
Was that? 91.
I took the oath in 1990. I was also motivated by, the invasion of Saddam Hussein. And on August 2nd, he invaded of 1990, he invaded Kuwait. And August 30th is when I, took the oath and joined what was called the delayed enlistment program, meaning I still had to finish my last year of high school, and but they had their hooks in me pretty much. And once I graduated high school and I had my ship date, I was off to boot camp, and that's what happened.
Yeah, I had a couple buddies in high school that were in an arrangement such as that. I remember when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, I was in sixth grade, Mr. Kauser's class at Lakes Middle School, and it was like he had. You know, it was a big, big deal, you know, because that was the first military conflict that our country had entered since Korea.
Well, you had Vietnam.
Vietnam.
And you had some smaller things that happened.
Like Panama.
Panama, Grenada, things like that.
Right.
But yeah, it was a big war. We were sending a lot of people over there. And of course, by the time I got in and went through boot camp and everything, it was all done.
Right.
And, It's kind of interesting, and I think, you know, most people that have served understand this, but definitely in the Marine Corps, when you join the Marine Corps and you train and you prepare and a conflict occurs and you don't participate, there is this feeling like you're not doing your job. You missed out. You're not up to par, up to standard with other Marines. And I definitely felt that when I finally got to my units and everybody was decorated from their service during Desert Storm, Desert Shield, and I was the young guy. Now, really, there's no way around that because every young service member is going to experience that, whether there's a conflict or not, and you're consistently trying to find ways of proving yourself. And I also missed out on, and I say missed out on, but that's honestly how I felt in those moments, was I felt like I missed out on Somalia. At the time, my wife was pregnant with my son and they only sent half the unit and they left me at home. And then I was selected to go on this commissioning program when Bosnia was heating up, and I just kind of felt like, am I ever going to be able to prove myself? And then later on, when I was commissioned, I was selected for an aviation contract that I didn't sign up for. And I was in flight school when 9/11 happened. I was actually airborne over the United States when 9/11 happened, and they were sending people to Afghanistan, and I'm still in school. And in my brain, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm missing out again. Well,
wow.
I ended up making up for it, but
yeah,
but that's what that process is like.
Absolutely. That's really interesting, Derek. Yeah. I think that, well, before we go down, I want people to be able to follow kind of your career path, because going in during the first conflict in the Middle East back in the 90s and then, you know, referencing, you know, being in flight school and being an F-18 pilot, there's a lot that had to occur between those two points in time.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of you're not the first Marine Corps aviator I've ever interviewed. The last was my senior year in high school for my senior English class. I interviewed a colleague of my mom's who was a F-4 a Phantom pilot in Vietnam.
Wow.
And he actually, and I don't want to deviate too much, but correct me, because I obviously you would know, I always thought that Marine Corps pilots are qualified for carrier landing, but most of what they still do is land-based. Is that accurate?
It depends on the unit.
Gotcha.
So, okay. So we, the Navy and Marine Corps team flies off of the aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
But Marines also have land-based aviation assets.
Yeah.
So I was in the F-18 Delta, was it the two-seater? So
okay.
I was F-18 Wizzo.
Yeah.
And
that's a weapons system officer.
Yes.
And formerly known as Rio back in the goose days.
Yeah, right? The F-14.
Yeah.
Different platform. Yeah. And
have you ever been to that Tillamook Air Museum?
I have not.
They have a Tomcat in there.
Oh, do they?
And they have scaffolding to where you can get up and look in the cockpit.
Yeah.
Dude, that backseat avionics, it's from the 70s.
Yeah.
It's It's insane what those guys were doing with what they had.
Yeah.
It's insane to me.
Yeah, it was an experience, that's for sure.
All right, I just went down like 20 different paths. So real quick, you had a successful career, or the Marine Corps saw something in you as an enlisted Marine to where they invested in you, they sent you to school at Oregon State.
Yeah.
And that was in the late 90s.
Mid to late 90s. I was there 95 to 99.
And you got a bachelor's in science and history, I think.
I got 2 degrees in history, a bachelor of arts and a bachelor of science, whatever that means. Yeah. But yeah, they gave me 2 diplomas. That's that was wonderful. Pretty cool.
And that is what allowed you to get your commission in the military.
Yep.
And then that is what allowed you to qualify to get selected to go to flight school.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bin Magazine's The Circling Podcast is proud to be supported by Boss Sports Performance. Visit BossSportsPerformance.com and learn how Boss is committed to helping athletes of all ages and all ability levels reach their fullest athletic potential through science-backed and evidence-based strength and conditioning with no gimmicks, no fads, and no shortcuts. Boss Sports Performance, inclusive to everybody and everybody. Book a class online. The first time's free.
Yeah, that was it was kind of a funny story because I was commissioned a ground officer. I had my plans were to be a ground officer and, you know, thinking I was going to be an infantry officer and have a platoon of Marines and attack the hill and all that stuff. And all Marine officers have to go to a school called the Basic School. It's 6 months in Quantico, Virginia. You learn basic infantry tactics, how to be a company level officer and things like that. And one night, I was in my room. I had to maintain a room and the barracks, and another Marine lieutenant filling some sort of leadership position comes into my room and he says, "Are you interested in flying at all?" And I'm just like, what are you talking about? He's like, "I need to know if you have any interest at all in flying." I said, "I don't know." He's like, "Do you have any interest at all in flying?" I said, "Okay, I guess I have an interest." He said, "All right, tomorrow at 1800 or whatever, you need to be in this building." And I'm like, dang it. I just gave up my Wednesday night and I didn't know what it was or what I was doing. And I show up and it was the aviation aptitude exam. And so I just sat down cold and took the test and passed. And I truly contribute that to, I didn't have any stress, anxiety going into the test and just knocked it out and was done, where I had a lot of friends that was their dream. They were studying, they were preparing. And
isn't that interesting?
And so I passed and I got my physical done and they said, "You're going to flight school." And I actually went to my boss and said, "This isn't what I want to do. This isn't what I got commissioned for. That's another 3-4 years of training. And, I got commissioned because I want to lead Marines and I don't want to sit in school." And he said, "Well, it doesn't really matter what you want. Yeah. You're going to flight school and
good luck." Interesting, because you hear that story a lot about the military. Uh-huh. I've never heard it where the coin, you know, lands on that side.
Yeah.
Meaning and that that's phenomenal.
Yeah. Some of my colleagues, like I said, a lot of people that was their dream, and I was kind of flippant about it.
Yeah.
And so it didn't land well with some of them. But then when I went to flight school, I was just kind of stubborn.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, if I'm going to do something, I want to be the best. Yeah. And I wanted F-18, so I had to perform.
Why did you want that
platform? I just looked at it as the best. So,
because it's badass looking.
You know? I thought it was awesome looking. I thought it was the sexiest platform, the best mission.
So
all those
other
things.
Other than the F-18 at that time, the other airframe of the Marine would have been like the Harrier?
The Prowler.
Yeah.
And didn't want anything to do with that.
And was the Harrier still being used?
The Harrier was being used, but it wasn't an option for the route that I was going.
Yeah. And that's a cool airplane. I mean, from what it can do.
Yeah.
I just remember being like 8 years old at the air show at Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane.
Yep.
And I'd never seen a vertical takeoff, you know, and when it's like a spaceship when you're a kid.
Yeah,
like,
that is pretty cool. Yeah. I'm biased towards the F-18, of course. So
I would hope so.
And we always have our inner service, you know, well, you put any boundary in the military and there's going to be a rivalry across it, whether it's East Coast, West Coast, air, ground, whatever units, platforms in the aviation community, fixed wing helicopters. But then, of course, even in the fixed wing side, there's rivalries across those platforms. I'm a bit biased for the F-18, but the vertical takeoff and landing is pretty, that's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. I mean, now they have the F-35.
That
thing's nuts.
Yeah.
Real quick, because this, I'm just going to ask you these questions because it's really interesting to me. Naval aviation was always kind of a childhood dream of mine. I obviously did not go that direction, but I've always been very intrigued with the process of things, getting from point A to point B, you know, because it's one thing to say, I'm going to be a pilot and of a F-18 Super Hornet. It's a whole other, reality getting there.
Yeah.
At what point during that pilot training, I would imagine it's just like drinking from a fire hydrant.
Yeah. I've compared it to like taking a midterm or a final every day.
Yeah.
But the difference is not only do you have to present the knowledge, then you have to perform.
Perform.
And it's physically and mentally exhausting.
Yeah.
And
was that the hardest thing you'd ever done at that point in your life, was go through flight school?
I don't know. I mean, it was difficult. The thing that I thought was difficult about it was really just the fatigue and the redundancy of it. The kind of the physics and those things just came relatively natural.
Yeah, you understood.
I understood. I could process it. And I could perform. And so, maybe it was. I'm not sure.
It's just interesting. It's kind of one of those vocations where you kind of have to, in a way, you have to have obviously what it takes between the ears, but then you have to have the physiology, right? Which you don't really have control over.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear stories all the time about people, not getting selected out because of reasons completely outside of their control.
There's so many different things. Personality too. Yeah. That used to be the personality section that people would fail out on, whatever that meant.
Yeah.
But they do look for a certain type of personality. Of course, you've heard of flying the envelope. Well, that's what they want you to do. They want you to go to that very line, don't cross it, but figure out how to walk that line in performance of that type of duty. And then there's the if you get airsick and you just can't control that, and there's people that got washed out for that, and they have the thing that we call the spin and puke, where they just send them to get airsick consistently and then hopefully you get over it. And that would have been the hardest thing for me. I'm like, thank goodness I never got airsick.
I always think of that scene in Spies Like Us with Chevy Chase and Dan Aykroyd when they're getting spun around in the centrifuge. Is that what you're talking about?
It's something like that, but instead of just the practicing against the G-force, they're just making their vestibular system go out of whack so that they get nauseous. And so not just, I have to deal with all these G's and keep the blood in my brain and things like that. This is trying to keep your stomach under control. And I'm a weenie when I get sick, so I couldn't imagine what those folks went through. And if I was one of those people that just got sick all the time, I definitely would. It would have been the hardest thing ever. Maybe your arms aren't long enough, or that you have to fit in the cockpit a certain way, or you don't understand weather. I mean, you see people get washed out for all sorts of just interesting and crazy things where they can't figure out how the clouds are formed or how to read these things, or the physics of it, or they can't pass a swim qual, or there's so many different ways to get washed out. And if they can't explain something, meaning Navy medicine, they're not going to take a chance on you.
No.
If you come into the doctor and you're like, I don't know, it's weird. Every other Tuesday I sneeze at about 1 a.m. And they're like, well, we can't explain that. You're washed out.
Yeah.
If it's something that they can treat and they have research on how to treat this with people that go to altitude, then you're fine. But if they can't explain it, then you're gone.
Yeah.
They're just not going to test you in an aircraft in that environment. And so I didn't have any of those issues, and I was able to perform. And so I just, luck of the draw and stubbornness also.
And
had
you
a
weren't
little bit
worried about those issues.
That was I tell people that that was the biggest thing that I had, because I wasn't consistently stressed about washing out at flight school. I always thought, well, if I get washed out, there's 75% of the jobs in the Marine Corps as an officer I'd be happy to do.
Yeah. That's a good leadership quality, being able to walk around, kind of recognizing things to be worried about, but then not necessarily shouldering them.
Yeah. And so I took that anxiety out and was able to perform, and I hated flight school too. I hated it. I hated flight school. I hated, once you get winged, then you go learn your platform. So you'll get winged and then you'll go to what we call it the RAG, but it's the fleet replacement squadron, where you learn the specific platform, like the F-18. And that, for me, that was another year, and I hated that too. But then once I got to the fleet, and got to an operational gun squadron, then it was like, oh
yeah,
now I'm doing my job.
Yeah.
This is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I was in an incredible squadron, and I got to deploy immediately and start supporting, you know, Marines and others on the ground. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ben Magazine's The Circling Podcast is brought to you by Back Porch Coffee Roasters. Back Porch offers high quality coffees that are ethically sourced directly from family operated farms and freshly roasted and brewed in Bend, Oregon. Visit BackPorchCoffeeRoasters.com to learn more, or better yet, stop into one of their four locations in Bend and experience coffee as it's meant to be.
Yeah, so much to talk about, man.
Yeah.
At what point in your training do they assign you the role of weapon system officer versus pilot?
Yeah. So I was picked right from the beginning to go naval flight officer route. And then depends on what platform you end in, been as far as weapon system officer.
But you still go through primary flight school?
Yeah. Well, it's changed now. But when I went through, you would start flying and you're doing all the stick and rudder stuff, and then at some point they like, okay, you've got enough of that.
Yeah.
Enough of that, and then you you start focusing more on radar and intercepts and everything else, all the other things that you're doing in the aircraft. And then when you go to, you know, your platform, then you're really learning how to utilize that. I mean, it's a massive weapon system.
Yeah.
You know, it's an airplane with it. And so, and then you learn everything about that. And yeah, and then implementing that is pretty impressive.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet you formed some incredible relationships with your time in the Marine Corps and the aviation component or chapter.
Yeah, across the board, but definitely I'm still incredibly close with a number of my colleagues from the squadron that I deployed with and kind of grew up in the squadron with, and, you know, shared hardship as far as flight school and things like that. And then going down range together and supporting.
Have you lost some friends?
Yeah. You know, even, that was one thing that I thought was, you know, even before participating in, combat, aviation is, it's not forgiving.
Yeah. It's
and,
dangerous.
When you make a mistake. Yeah. Many times it costs your life or other people's lives. And so, unfortunately had lost a lot of colleagues and aviation mishaps and things like that.
Yeah. So, do you still enjoy aviation on like a private level?
No, actually, since I left the military, actually since I left the Hornet.
Yeah. Which was what year?
2007.
Okay.
Was my last flight in the F-18. Yeah. I wasn't my end of my Mercury. I still had 7 years in the Marine Corps, but, my last flight in the F-18 was 2007. And the only flight I've only done one kind of in the cockpit flight since then in the private sector. And that was, just with a colleague up in, Big Bear Lake
In California.
Yeah. And we flew down into the desert and then took that little prop, took us forever to climb back out of the desert, back up to Big Bear. But, and I kind of at the time was like, oh, maybe I'll go and get my private pilot's license and things like that. And I was kind of toying with the idea. At the time, I was in school working on a PhD, so I didn't have a lot of free time. But then when I finished that, I just thought, there's so many other things that I want to go do that.
I get that.
It's lower on the priority list.
And so. It's kind of like, and I don't think a lot of people, understand that right away, but I've thought more about that. I was kind of that way with snowboarding in a way, you know, right after your career, you're kind of like, there's a lot of other things to do in life.
Yeah.
And then, you know, snowboarding is a little bit easily more accessible than flying an airplane, but you know, you get back to it.
Flying is expensive.
It's
too.
Wicked expensive. Yeah, so. I have 10 hours. Yeah. 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 10 hours from like 2001, and then I ran out of money. So
that's what happens. And so if I'm going to spend money on something, I have all sorts of different things. I think I told you, like, started mountaineering, and
I know
that's interesting, but again, that's not cheap either, but it's fun.
So much to do. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's another book I'm going to give you. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mere Mortals. Okay. And it's called 4,000 Weeks because that's how many weeks you will have lived if you lived
average lifespan
of 80.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm over 40 now, and, you know, there's not a lot of weeks left, and there's a lot of life to try to experience.
Yeah.
Which, you know.
And getting older, too, it's like, man, my body doesn't do what it used to. That's really discouraging.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that too. Maybe next episode, next time we get together, we'll have a part two to this. Okay, my friend. So you had a successful career as a weapon system officer in the F-18, and then you, this is just such a unique military experience that I think it would be a disservice to not mention it, but then you were selected to fill a role back on the ground as a Marine, implanted within or as part of a special operations group, which I think at the time used to be Marine Force Recon and then was transitioned to MARSOC.
Yeah.
And that just has to do more with like the intricacies of special forces stuff in the U.S. government.
Yeah. So in 2006, 2007 was when they created the Marine arm of special operations.
Yeah.
Before that, the Marine Corps always had the force reconnaissance component. And they never had a place in the special operations community, at least as part of Special Operations Command. And so they were doing special operations and things like that, but they didn't have an actual unit. And so in 2006, 2007, they actually took down the force reconnaissance flag and they put up the MARSOC flag. Mm-hmm. And I became a part of what is now 1st Raider Battalion. At the time was 1st Marine Special Operations Battalion. It sounds a lot cooler now. And the Marine Corps started building out their special operations component, and I got to be a plank holder with that. So I came in as an aviation expert, and that's what the Marines do. We always have aviation experts in every ground unit.
And that's to communicate effectively with the air support?
Yeah, we're very much, you know, we want to do everything. And that really helps us in our mission in the sense that many times you know the people that you're talking to in the aircraft or on the ground, and you're very read into the mission. You know, we all go through basic infantry tactics. And so that helps us perform really, really efficiently. And it's something that we take a lot of pride in. And so every aviator goes through a ground tour, and it's typically 9 to 12 months. And the reason that it's that length is that gets you back to your squadron and you don't lose your qualifications, and you can immediately start executing the mission in the jet again or aircraft again. And so the MARSOC assignment was going to be at least 3 years. And I was just really excited about it. And you've already heard me say, like, oh, well, that's the best. And so in my mind, ever since I was a young Marine, you know, the force reconnaissance community was the best in the Marine Corps. And that was something that I wanted to do. I have a few stories about that. And then I ended up in the aviation community because that's where the Marine Corps wanted to send me. And so I still had these aspirations to serve in that capacity on the ground. And so when my time was coming, it just happened that was when they were creating MARSOC.
Wow.
And I
good
had built,
timing again.
Yeah. Well, I had built enough relationships too that,
and you had a reputation.
Yeah. And had proven myself at least enough that, was a meat eater and I could go hopefully, hold my own in that community, and did, and gotten invited to go over there, and went and initially was part of the battalion as they were starting up the companies, and was a member of the first Delta Company, Marine Special Operations Company, Delta, and deployed with them. And to me, it was very, very much like being in a squadron. And, you know, the ready rooms compared to the team rooms, where there's a lot of similarities. You have a lot of type A personalities, people that are overachievers and the very, very best at what they do. And so I felt very comfortable in that environment, wanted to be a part of it, wanted to be associated with, wanted to execute the mission, love the mission. And yeah, so I got to do that. And yeah, it was, and it's something that I'm very proud of as far
you
as my
should
career.
Be.
Yeah.
That's really, from the, my understanding, it's incredibly rare to, for someone like, as a, what rank were you when you
I was a captain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is so. That, is that normal for a captain to,
that's, well, that's usually about the time that you're going to do a ground tour.
Okay.
And I had actually done, I was a senior captain. I had done an extended time in the F-18. I had done four deployments, I think. And, I had actually was supposed to start my ground tour before that. And I was asked to join another squadron on another Middle East deployment.
Gotcha.
And so on. And for me, that was one of the biggest compliments I could ever receive.
Yeah.
From a commander that's taken his unit to combat. And they asked me to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And I mean, you, to me, it's like something you can't say no
Absolutely.
To. It's as far as a, you know, a Marine or a professional warrior, that person trusted me enough to join his unit, because he wanted to make this unit the strongest possible in supporting these Marines and others down range. And so that, yeah, I was completely humbled by that. And, it's kind of neat. The gentleman, his name is, at the time, he's Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Mo Mahoney, who's now Lieutenant General Mo Mahoney. So he's up there and doing some pretty good things for himself.
You have a really neat community of friends.
Yeah.
Well, it speaks to your character, man. This is really fun getting to know you. I had a question about your time really quick back at OSU, because you studied history, and there's something that I thought was interesting that I wanted to touch on that I heard you say in one of your other interviews. If you don't know your history, you're kind of doomed to repeat it. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Okay. I mean, it's an opportunity to learn. You know, it's kind of like you can make mistakes on your own, but it's a lot easier to live vicariously through somebody else's mistakes and take those learning points and hopefully apply them to your own life. Now, I can't remember who, you know, that quote was from, as far as, you know, learn history or you're doomed to repeat it type of thing. But, yeah. And for me, studying history was, you know, especially reflecting back on the study of history, and, you know, I'm still engaged in my own personal study of history, but it's less about events and dates and things like that, and far more about the human condition and general individual and collective psychology and the things that we do to each other over time.
And that's exactly where I wanted to go with this, because it was, you've referenced kind of this human experience being really the same story, just told in different ways at different points in time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're living in kind of weird times right now. I mean, I don't think there's any denying it. There's a lot going on. Being kind of with that mindset, is there kind of any lesson of in history that you think our country would do well to remember?
Several.
just the couple that come to mind.
You know, well, I think about kind of reflecting on an earlier part of this conversation, where we're referencing the comfort crisis and these luxuries that we find ourselves living in. And then it makes me think of, you know, the fall of Rome, where Rome, you know, grew in power and the citizens became so protected that, you know, you start forgetting what it took to get to this moment. You take things for granted, right? And it's natural, especially if you haven't experienced it. So I think about that, and I think about, you know, what have we as a collective, individuals or collective, really sacrificed on grand scale since the end of World War II?
Not much.
Yeah, no. And so you look at that generation and you know, they participated in that conflict as a collective, and many, many, many went off and fought the war, but then people at home had to black out their windows, and they had to plant victory gardens, and, you know, they weren't just living a regular life where we just finished, quote unquote, finished the long war, if you will, in Afghanistan. So the longest conflict that we've been involved in, and a very, very small number of people compared to our entire population, participated in that conflict. And what was the biggest sacrifice at home? You know, the example I use is, you know, the biggest concern people have is whether their internet is working or not. And, you know, are you caught up on all the episodes of Game of Thrones or whatever the current series, Yellowstone, to use a more current example or something like that. And people just generally aren't impacted by these bigger events in our nation. We have this incredible luxury of having these borders that are separated by oceans from most of the hotspots in the world. And so kind of when I reflect on history, is just like the cycle of, hey, we're going to build a great nation, great empire, if you want to call it that. And we're going to protect everybody in our circle and do what we can to protect them. And initially everybody understands that and what it takes to get there. And then once you've created this empire and this incredible nation and people are protected, well, then they forget the sacrifices that went into it. And those things become less important until they're beating down your door. And so that's my biggest fear is, you know, what's going to knock us off the top or not take away these things that we have that we fought so hard to have. And so that's, you know, when I reflect on, you know, the past and where we are today, that's some of the stuff that scares me. And
I think there's reason to, you know, be concerned.
Yeah.
And I thinking about what you just said, it's one reason I've always had the utmost respect for active military members or veterans is that collective sacrifice. They really, you know, anymore in our society, those are the people that represent that for everybody now, right?
Well, you can even take it away from the military too, where what's happened is people care far more about themselves and their convenience than they care about other things. I mean, you can talk about the climate.
Yeah.
You know, you can deny it, but it's kind of hard to deny when you've experienced it. And I've been around the world and I can see the impact of climate change, not only here in our own backyard and in Bend, but in several other places in the world. And, you know, it's in order to have an impact on that, people are going to have to change their lifestyle. And if it comes down to a collective, that's going to be tough. You know, there's just
kind of goes back to that reevaluating your values and like, am I so married to this idea that I'm willing to, you know, not revisit it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Based on,
and I don't know if there's a solution, you know, the population keeps on growing. So,
yeah, I think there is. I think, well, I don't know.
It's tough.
Yeah. You know, it is tough. It's lately, it's hard not to worry a little. You know?
Oh, I mean, when you see the impact of these fires around here and, you know, our water supply and snowpack and all that stuff, I pay attention to that and what's going on. And
you have to.
It's scary.
Yeah. Okay, man. We've covered a lot. Let's keep going. You doing all right?
I'm doing great.
All right. I'm guessing you were in pretty good shape in your MARSOC days.
I was in decent shape. Yeah. Much better than what I am now.
We'll have to talk more about that. It's so interesting to me, but I'd love to hear more about your days and with the MARSOC team. So your job was you communicated with primarily your area of expertise was communicating with air support.
Yeah. Planning, mission planning,
okay.
Execution, yeah. All those different things.
That's right,
things.
Because you were the commanding officer of that.
No, I became the executive officer of
executive
our company.
Executive officer. No. All right. I'm not very good with that's military
right.
rank. But
that's all right.
Yeah. One thing you've talked about, and because you've subsequently gone on after your time and in the Marine Corps, you then kind of put your nose to the grindstone in terms of your own furthering of your intellect.
Yeah. Education can oftentimes present the opportunity or more opportunities yeah. for success.
Yeah.
And that was definitely something that I saw. And that's also connected to my youth.
Yeah.
Where, you know, my mom didn't graduate high school. And so, so then, you know, initially it was like, well, I have to do this kind of just, it seemed like something I had to do. And then it turned into, you know, these educational goals represented success and progression to yeah. me and they brought incredible opportunities for me. And so, yeah, I think, you know, attaining credentials and things like that definitely open doors. Our systems are problematic, of course, now, but it was something that important to me. I kind of see my brain as another muscle that you need to make sure it doesn't atrophy, and so that was what I did to kind of try and strengthen it and make it more valuable to the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've done a lot of work, man, and it's pretty impressive. I want to read your credentials here, and please correct me if I get any of this wrong. But so you got your undergraduate double major. Yeah, what do you
Something
say?
Like that.
So,
yeah.
Anyways, you had success at Oregon State. Then you went on and you got a master's degree in higher education leadership from University of San Diego. Then you went to the Stanford School of Business and got a certificate. And is that correct?
Correct.
And then you most recently completed your PhD in leadership again through the University of San Diego.
Correct.
Yeah. So kind of a theme here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I can't do much more after that. Although I have considered going back and getting an MBA.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, theme within, you know, obviously with pursuits, but also theme within the scope of what you were studying. I mm-hmm. mean, talk to me about leadership to you. I
yeah.
mean, that's a big part of your life that you've invested, you know, a lot of time into becoming an expert in.
Yeah. You know, I really was initially exposed to kind of the practice of leadership or even studying it, if you will, in the military. And the military does a really good job of realizing the value in that and then giving people the capacity to immediately implement leadership practice. And they do it through chase-based leadership theory. And they do that for a right reason because it's really easy to consume as an individual, like, okay, what does integrity mean? And how do I represent that? So you have 250,000 people join the military every year. You need to present this leadership to them, and then hopefully they can turn around and practice it. And but then they also have a system that really encourages people to do so and allows them to do it successfully, whether they do it or not. And then my personal approach to leadership was kind of observation at that point, where I would, you know, look at what people are doing well and mimic it, and then look at things that people are doing that I didn't really care for and say, I don't want to do that. And let me make sure I avoid that. And so built my toolbox that way. And then when I started my master's at the University of San Diego, was really the first time I was exposed to in-depth leadership theory, like intentionally examining leadership theory. And it was higher education leadership program, where many of those programs are more higher education, kind of the structure of higher education and the systems within higher education and things like that, where there was some of that in my program. It really focused more on leadership. And that was something that I really liked about the program and learning more about all sorts of different leadership theories. And then pulling those pieces out so I could kind of create my own approach and own philosophy. And I was so intrigued by it that when I had the opportunity to go back and get a PhD and I wanted to study leadership further, that that's the approach that I wanted to take. And that's what drove me back to the University of San Diego to dive deeper in it. Now, I kept on focusing on the military and higher education space. And that was, you know, dissertation and things like that, because you have to create a product to get a PhD. And that's what I created. But then I also really got into kind of how military transitioned from that system into new systems, and all sorts of interesting things. So I just, yeah, I'm fascinated by it. I regularly consume, you know, books and articles and stuff about it.
I noticed a lot of your titles of the books on your bookshelves are familiar, and some aren't, but a lot of them are, you know, one of the main themes is surrounds leadership.
Well, and it really frames how I approach a lot of books. Yeah. Too. You know, I might read a military book, but I'll really examine it through the leadership lens. And that's kind of, I can't turn that switch off almost. And there's certain elements, especially when you come to, when it comes to like group dynamics and things, like once you learn and see things, you can't unsee them, then it informs almost anything that you do in a group environment. So yeah, I can't turn that switch off, but it's something that I really enjoy and dive deep into.
How do you, you know, when you're in the process of getting your PhD and you're, you know, I remember some supervising physician at one point in a rotation told me, you're never as smart as you are when you're in grad school.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of truth to that, right? Yeah. So at this point in your life and with how much you've invested into, how do you kind of continue to tone that, you know, more theoretical kind of component of leadership more?
Yeah. Well, you always have the opportunity to practice it. Which it's a lot easier to learn than it is to practice.
Yeah.
You can be really smart when it comes to the, you know, the theory, but implementing it is something completely different. But you know, not only do I have my day job, which of course includes leadership components, but I also engage with groups around the country in presenting theory and all sorts of different presentations and research. And I have a dissertation committee that I'm on, so another student that's coming up, and now I get to kind of examine their approach to it. So staying involved in the kind of the research and the academic side is something that helps stay sharp, if you will. But I mean, honestly, that's very true. Like, you really aren't the smartest point in your life if you're going through a PhD is probably when you're in grad school, because you're reading all the newest stuff, you're being drilled on it on a regular basis and critiqued on your work, and then of course once you graduate, well, there's that pressure is gone and stuff, which is also why I think a lot of people, the biggest dropout point for PhDs is the dissertation part, and that's where it's all initiative. It's all self-motivated. There's nobody that's telling you that there's a deadline or anything like that. And so you take away that component of a like regular classroom work where you're, this is due on Friday and this is due in 2 weeks. And you know, we have a midterm and a final or whatever happens to be, you take away that component and that structure. And that's when a lot of people need that and they can't self-motivate and then they just drop off.
You got to constantly revisit the why, huh?
Mm-hmm. Well, I just created a schedule for myself.
That's smart.
I put deadlines down and I talked to my chair when I was in that point, and she said, this is a really aggressive timeline. You know, it might be tough. And I said, oh, it's going to be tough and you can torture me all you want, but we're going to meet this deadline, my own self-imposed deadline. And we made it.
And what were you doing in life when you were getting your PhD?
I was working in higher education.
You were? Okay.
Yeah. At the time I was running programs I went between the University of San Diego and San Diego State University, and also did some nonprofit work with the Travis Manion Foundation. But I was working in the environment that I was researching. So I also had this nice anecdotal experience that I could pull from and inform my research. So that made life a lot easier. And I actually, when I was going through my PhD and I was determining my dissertation topic and things like that, I actually changed it to focus on that area specifically to keep my sanity and manage time a lot better.
So, smart, man.
Yeah.
Super smart. So was part of your dissertation, did it focus on this idea of lead where your voice is most effective within a group?
Personally, it did.
Okay.
Because at the time, I was researching the area that I was working in, but the topic itself didn't really have anything to do with that. The topic... Yeah, now we're getting into some boring stuff. It was factors influencing decision making for veterans when they're accessing higher education, and there was a gap in the knowledge, and I wanted to create some knowledge to help inform that population, be successful in that space, and also create some data that could help quality institutions counter some of the predatory practices that were out there.
One thing I want to do before we completely get out of your time in the military, I want to hear about your call sign, the story behind, because you've referenced it. Your call sign was Cosmo.
Yes, yes.
And for those that don't know, a call sign is kind of becomes your name.
Yep.
And there's typically some sort of story.
Yes. Yeah, so... it's part of aviation culture, and so you'll join a squadron, and many times they'll give you kind of a temporary call sign until you can have a call sign review.
Yeah,
and really they give you that temporary one just so they can kind of observe and then wait for you to do something real stupid, and then they'll assign you a call sign. And so, like, when I was going through flight school and stuff, the early thing people used to call me was Normal. My last name's Abby, so Abby Normal. And okay, that's great, but it doesn't really flow off the tongue or anything like that. So when I first checked into my first gun squadron, fleet squadron in the Marine Corps, they would call me Normal. And all right. And one of the big things is you never want to show that you hate a call sign,
right?
Because you will never lose it.
Yeah.
It's like
blood
and,
in the water.
Oh my. Yeah. And actually, there's talk about this tradition going away. You know, that's like,
come on.
So yeah, it's really, really sad. But I joined my first squadron, and we deploy right away. And we're doing Operation Southern Watch, and then immediately go right into Operation Iraqi Freedom. Yeah. So doing that, and I was on the night page, so I was flying missions at night, and we're penetrating into Iraq from Kuwait and doing these missions kind of early. And we come back one evening and it's 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And we go to what we call midrats, which is just midnight rations at the chow hall. The Air Force had this tent set up where Marines like to go because the Air Force always has better food. And we were just sitting in there having midrats or breakfast or whatever it was. And I had made the decision that when we deployed, I had shaved my head enough, and I wasn't going to shave my head like so many people were doing. We were living in these austere conditions, even for aviators, these austere conditions, and, cleaning facilities and things were limited. And so my hair was getting long, and I wouldn't do anything with it. It would just get out of control. And so one of the senior Marines in the squadron, two of them were sitting across the table from me, and they just looked over and they're like, "Man, your hair is out of control." And they said, "You look like Kramer from Seinfeld."
Nice.
And so, then you saw the light bulb go off on them, and they're like, "That's it, Cosmo Kramer." And so then we had a call sign review, the next gathering of all the air crew, and they said, "All right, it's either going to be Cosmo or Kramer. What does the squadron want?" And they chose Cosmo, and then that was it.
I was
forever known as Cosmo.
That's a good story.
Well, I used to lie when I was single and out and talking to girls and trying to build relationships and stuff like that. And they'd say, "Well, why do they call you Cosmo?" And I'd say, "Oh, did they tell you that story? That's so embarrassing." And I'd say I did underwear advertisements in Cosmopolitan magazine. And for some reason, they never thought I was lying. And I always had to like, "No, I'm just joking. That really didn't happen." But I would be like, "Oh, it was like
no
the October, way. November, December issues of whatever year." And I'm like, "Really? You think I'm underwear material? Thank you, but no, that's not it."
I like it, man. It's all these little questions that you never really, you're always curious about.
Yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad that your career in the military, man. Thank you. I mean, you, you know, I I talked with John and Allison out at Centurion Veterans Ranch when I did that episode about just, you know, thanking our vets. And, you know, sometimes I think some of us just say it without thinking about it, but I really do appreciate all that you've done as a service member.
And, well, I appreciate the acknowledgement.
I know you've gotten a lot out of it, and I know they got a lot out of you for what you did, but, you know, you've had an amazing military career that, you know, and just one of those areas would have been incredibly successful, and you have, like, this really interesting, unique kind of tapestry of on the ground, above the ground, back down. And now what you're doing as we transition kind of into what you're up to now is it just seems to really set the stage for your role that you kind of stepped into from what it sounds like is an opportunity from just picking up the telephone when you were the history guy in the ready room.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, tell people that story.
Well,
specifically how you got or were first exposed to what was at that point in time, it sounds like the Bent Prop Project, and
correct,
then ultimately what's transitioned into Project Recover.
Yeah. So I was still in my very first squadron, and we had just come back from Iraq, and the phone in the ready room rings one day. This is 2003.
And the ready room, for, I think I have an understanding, but my understanding, the way it's kind of like where you guys are, you and your squadron, the pilots and officers are, mm-hmm, that's where you hang.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll have meetings there. It's where the duty officer stays, yeah, the central phone, you know, everything, the schedule,
it's like
weather,
your clubhouse.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Very central to any fighter squadron or squadron in general. It's the ready room. It's, yeah, the central hub of a squadron, if you will. Yeah. And so, the phone rang and the duty officer answered it and, you know, asked a couple questions. And then he kind of looks at me and, Cosmo, hey, you're the historical officer here. Take this call. Okay. And so I get on, and it was this gentleman named George Buranik. And I was like, how can I help you? And he says, well, I'm actually looking for points of contact from World War II. And I'm like, oh, we don't have any points of contact from World War II members. And I kind of asked why. And he says, well, I was in the squadron during World War II, and every year we have a reunion, and this year we're having it in Indiana, and I'm just trying to invite all the squadron members that I can. And I was like, wow, well, I don't have any points of contact, but I'd like to come out to the reunion. And he's like, well, come on out. And so me and another gentleman took a jet out, flew out to Indiana to join them for the reunion. And, we had just come back from Iraq, so all the World War II cadre were just,
wow,
hey, tell us about Iraq and the F-18s. And we're kind of like, who cares about Iraq and F-18s? Tell us about World War II and Corsairs and Wildcats.
Right.
And they're like, who cares about that? So it was really neat to just kind of, yeah, come together. And so just started becoming friends and building relationships with these World War II guys. And they said, you need to meet this guy, Pat Scannon. He's going to Palau every year, and he's searching for MIAs as part of this group that he created called the Bent Prop Project. And he's coming out here to give us an update on his work in Palau. And at the time, I was in 121, and 121 flew out of Peleliu, which is part of Palau. And I actually had seen a link online about the Bent Prop Project when I was coming to 121 doing my own research on the squadron. And as it turned out, that year, me and my colleague had to leave. And so we missed Pat by like 20 minutes. And so, but in my, conversations with the World War II veterans, I was like, you know, next year you need to come to San Diego. We need to do this together. The old squadron, the new squadron.
Yeah.
Let's do this. And so I helped them organize the 2004, reunion, and they did. And they came out, and Pat joined them. And Pat and I became acquainted. We became friends. And he very quickly invited me to be a member of the Bent Prop Project. And I was just super excited to be a part of it. I was very impressed with the work that he was doing. It seemed like the right thing to do. And if I had the capacity to assist, then I should do this.
Yeah.
And so he invited me to be in the organization. And at the time, I was deploying quite a bit. And it took me a couple of years before I was able to go on my very, very first mission. But I actually came back from a deployment and in the Middle East, and I unpacked my sea bag and I packed my bag, and I joined them in Palau, and we found an MIA site that year, and it was a member of my former squadron, the World War II squadron that I was doing the reunions
at. That is unbelievable. Yeah. Talk to people really quick about kind of the camaraderie within a squadron, regardless of time, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is it, because I've not, you know, not being in the military, but it seems almost like it's kind of like you're part of a sports team at one point in history, but you have that. I mean,
that's a really good example. And there's actually some academic stuff that would support that analogy. So, you know, the Marine Corps itself is very culture focused, and the identity of being a Marine is very, very strong. You know, across time, when Marines greet each other, it's always Semper Fidelis, Semper Fi,
right.
You know, that stuff. There's a Korean War era Marine that lives in my neighborhood here, and we'll cross paths every once in a while and stop and talk. And so you have the Marine Corps on that level, but then even within the Marine Corps and even other branches, you know, there's certain units that you build additional strong bonds around. And, you know, those could be infantry units. They are also fighter squadrons that come with a common culture, yeah. Shared hardship, shared training to get to that point. You know, everybody knows what it took to get there and made it type of thing. And then that's further enhanced, of course, when you deploy and things like that, find yourself in dangerous situations. And those bonds just become very, very strong. One, you can talk about those experiences with each other in a very safe environment without worrying about judgment or anything like that.
Right.
So it's really easy to connect, even if there's a split in generations. So, you know, aviators from World War II or aviators from today, you kind of meet each other and you have similar stories and very same culture,
shared
even across time. Yeah. Even if you weren't in it at the same time, in this case, it can include the experience of combat, but I think the experience of combat really builds those bonds as well. I'm dependent on you for my life. You're dependent on me for your life. And even if that you're talking to somebody that was in a different unit, or a different time, and you weren't in that fighting position together, you understand each other to a certain extent that even is unspoken. And so I think there's elements of that in fighter squadrons, especially fighter squadrons that deployed in combat.
That was kind of, not to get too far ahead because I want to go into it in more detail, but this is a good time to bring up. There's a really good example of that in What Remains, the movie that Project Recover did you guys just put that out, or is it
was
been
released
out
in December?
December, yeah. Yes. But with Marcus Luttrell and that older Marine, Mr. Bergen, at the end,
Harvey Bergen,
that camaraderie that they share is exactly what you just described.
And that's one thing I love about that film is they do this incredible job of weaving the present and the past.
Yeah, they do
together,
yeah.
And they use RV and Marcus Luttrell as the example of the current veteran and the World War II veteran, and the experience being, I mean, the quote where they like, you know, if he wants to talk about it, I'll listen all day. And they both say the exact same thing in separate moments, which I think is just drives that point home. You know, both of them were in, you know, very, very dangerous situations, had to rely on their teammates and things and made it through, and others didn't.
Right.
And they can talk to those pieces with each other and just understand each other with just a short statement. And you don't need to get into detail. Yeah. You don't even need to talk about it. You just understand.
Yeah.
And I thought they did a really good job with that in the film.
I agree 100%. It was a pleasure to watch. But going back just quickly here. So the fact that the first MIA that you were involved with was a member of your current present day squadron at that time.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean or at least it seemed like it.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Like that's just, what are the chances?
Well, and you know, I remember preparing. 40s. Yeah. I remember preparing for that mission and kind of reviewing all the cases of people that we were going to be looking for. And I was in Iraq flying real world missions, knowing I was going to go home and then go to Palau. And I was reviewing these records. And I remember distinctly just thinking, you know, wouldn't it be unreal if we could find this 121 missing Marine? And that was the one discovery we had that year.
That's insane. Yeah. What was it like going from, like, you know, present day Middle East military conflict, you know, state of the art equipment, like, you know, it's like a futuristic war compared to the environment that you were volunteering in the South Pacific, where it was, I mean, still very much primitive in ways, mm-hmm. old technology in terms of what you guys were, you know, the airframes that you were looking for, and just everything about that era was just, it must have been in significant contrast to what your day to day was.
It was and it wasn't. So you could see the similarities between just day to day life in a fighter squadron or fighting a conflict. And then, of course, you can see the differences and the scale of those differences and things like that. So it was a combination of both, and then the juxtaposition of leaving the Middle East and then going to the South Pacific.
Right.
For me, it was crazy. Night and day, but it was actually a really nice transition. I mean, where I just kind of had a chance to let my hair down. That was probably my best transition home from a deployment, was leaving right away, because there wasn't really any pressure. We were working hard, but it wasn't a stressful environment. Especially back then when we used to do those missions, it was probably the lowest stress I would have throughout the year, was the 2 to 4 weeks I would spend on a mission, just because all I was doing was focusing on, you know, searching the jungles or the water for these MIAs, and the rest of the world didn't, you know, intrude on me.
Slowed
and
down.
Yeah. So it was really, really nice, which is actually very similar to, you know, running missions in a conflict. It's like you have Groundhog Day, if you will. It's just happening over and over again. Yeah. Different mission, but you don't have any concerns outside of that, or hopefully you don't. You
know, right.
Most of the time you're not really engaged with the outside world. You're just focused on the mission at hand. And there's something nice about that. And I think many times that's something, when you talk to people that say they miss combat, I think that's the big element. One is the responsibility and the impact that you're having. But the other is you cut out all the nonsense.
Right.
There's no just frill of, you know, everyday life.
Which is, again, going back to our culture, you know, I mean, that's all we hear, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I'm often, you know, working in a surgical subspecialty. I'm not a surgeon, but I've worked with a lot of surgeons over the years, and I've always... It's become immediately clear the surgeons that worked in any sort of military context in the past, because the level of distraction and stress, and what oftentimes just throws younger civilian surgeons in a complete tailspin, is like an absolute non-issue.
Yeah.
And it's always fascinated me. So there is definitely something to operating in that higher level of, you know, demand, what's demanded of you. And then, you know, coming back down to, oh, this really? Take a breath.
I have a really good friend who is our flight surgeon in my squadron. And I mean, the guy is unreal. He was flight surgeon of the year for the Navy. When we were deployed, this guy would... you know, we didn't really have any serious issues in the squadron. And so in his downtime, he would do CASIVAC missions, where he'd be in the back of a helicopter pulling Marines out of hot LZs and things like
that.
Wow. Well, during COVID, when COVID was getting, when starting and the hospitals were overwhelmed, and he was doing emergency medicine, he called me one day and, you know, he was stressed about the patients and everything. But the biggest, thing he wanted to talk about was the other medical staff around him that was just, and their capacity to handle this.
Isn't that interesting?
And we had some really, really deep, heavy conversations around that. Which is, and I mean, and I told him when we talked that, you know, I don't want to wish this on you for anything, but if there's anybody that I should be in that situation, yeah, needs to be there, is him.
Yeah.
And he continues to handle it. And, but yeah, and that I think his capacity to handle that was because of his experience.
Right. That's incredibly interesting. Mm-hmm. That speaks to possibly the, you know, the, I don't know. I mean, that's opens up a lot of really interesting mm-hmm. questions as to just that level of training or life experience or what is required to kind of put out this product where you almost can't really be that unless you've gone through some sort of crucible.
Yeah. You know? And we're missing those crucibles. And I mean, I'm not somebody that thinks, I mean, I'm not against everybody serving. I think everybody should serve in some capacity. Yeah. It's not necessarily the military, but invest in the community in some way, like contribute in some way so that you have that appreciation.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not, I don't think everybody needs to be in a combat zone. That's for sure.
Right.
But you know, there,
well, just
if you can process it the right way, you're left with, some incredible tools that allow you to, handle other similar situations in a higher capacity.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a one concept that I go back to, especially with military and vets and, but I experienced as an athlete to some degree mm-hmm. is this idea of identity experience, right? Like you kind of are defined by what you've done, not by what you're doing or mm-hmm. what you want to do. Mm-hmm. One thing that I kind of heard, in some of your interviews was this idea that, you know, a lot of vets struggle with that. Mm-hmm. You don't think you did, and that's kind of because your purpose just rolled into you. You just had a new mission, which was because you kind of were introduced to Project Recover and this idea of what to do with the rest of your life while you were in the military. When you transitioned out and have been doing this full time, that sense of purpose, why am I doing what I'm doing? You're able to apply a lot of the skill sets, whether it's leadership or logistic, all organization, all that probably transfers over to some degree. But do you think that's accurate? That's one reason why you don't struggle with that? Or
that's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
And
or maybe you struggle with it. I don't know.
Well, a lot less, I think. And so your reference to athletes is very accurate. And so actually some of my academic research dove into that because I was really, I was curious about it myself.
Yeah.
Like, why are people struggling in this transition? And the reason I asked the question was, you know, when you're in the military, you're constantly transitioning, going on deployment, coming back from deployment, executing orders. You just executed orders, getting new assignments. You're not stagnant at all.
Yeah.
And then general society isn't so stagnant anymore, right? Very few times nowadays does somebody work in the same factory for 40, 50 years. You retire, get the gold watch, and they're still hanging out with the people they hung out in high school. Still happens every once in a while, but not very often. And so I was really curious, like, what is it about this specific transition that causes so much friction for people? And part of it was identity. The other part of it was intimate relationships and purpose, which you mentioned. And then I also compared that to other groups that can find themselves in very similar situations. And many times it's professional or high end athletes that really spent a lot of time in their community where that was their identity. There's a distinct culture and everything around it. And like the military, at some point you're going to get older and you're probably going to have to transition into something else. And you get into an identity crisis. And if you haven't spent time really exploring what other intersecting identities you have that can put you in a tailspin, or how to have relationships with people that aren't professional snowboarders or Marines,
right?
You know, things like that, then that's a little bit tough. Like, how do I have healthy relationships with people that have a completely different experience than me? And then, you know, what's your new impact on the world? And for the military, especially, you have this newfound self-efficacy where the military provided all that, provided your identity, provided your relationships, and it gave you a purpose from the very, very first day that you entered. And then when you leave, now you have this self-efficacy that you get to pick, and that's really scary for a lot of people. to figure out what their new meaning in life is, what their purpose, legacy, generativity, and all that stuff is going to be. And so some people freeze because it's so scary and they're scared of failure and that's not an option and things like that, even though it is an option. So I see people struggle with that and similar other groups. And for me, I had a few things that really, really helped me. The Marine Corps sent me to college twice.
Yeah.
Sent me to Oregon State. There's not a lot of military around Oregon State.
Right.
And so I had early on, and I struggled. My first year at Oregon State, I really, really struggled. And with all those things, where how do I interact with these people? They give weight and, you know, currency to things that don't really matter. This seems kind of silly. And you know, I thought I was so old because I was 22, but I wish I was 22 again. And it took me about a year to figure out, like, oh, well, they're just living a different life. It's not better. It's not worse. It's different. And so that experience really helped me. And then when I went to get my master's, I was kind of out of the military again. So I had one foot in, one foot out, for 2 years. That one was a little bit different because I had combat experience and I literally left Afghanistan, came back and started college, which was quite the transition. And that was tough as well. But those really informed my future when I was going to really separate from the Marine Corps. I had an opportunity to figure out who I was besides Derek the Marine. I had relationships with other people that weren't Marines or didn't have combat experience, and I knew how to build solid relationships around that. And then purpose piece, I started with the Bent Prop Project, which would become Project Recover when I was active duty.
Yeah.
And it was very much a part of my life and I wasn't going to let it go.
Right.
And I also started my work in higher ed when I was still active duty. So I had those pieces and value in other circles, at least in my own eyes. And so I didn't have that drop off or perceived drop off of purpose. And I just started doubling down on that. And so I think that helped my, those areas quite a bit, where if you're not conscious of it or you're not thinking about it, and then the next thing you know, you're not in those circles anymore. That can have an incredibly negative impact on people, and it can take them a while to get through it. And some people don't even get through it. I mean, I've given that presentation and talked about that with veterans, recently separated veterans or just going to separate. And then I've also had veterans that have been out for 20, 30 years who have said, nobody's ever even brought this up before.
Yeah.
And it's this light bulb goes off. They're like, holy smokes. And awareness is key. Because then you can start practicing that self-efficacy and figuring out, okay, I'm mapping my own path here and I'm going to do what I want to do and have an impact where I want to have that impact. And once people harness that, then they're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was lucky. Very, very lucky.
It's just an area that a lot of opportunity for massive growth for people just by, like what you said, just mentioning it.
Yeah.
It becomes mentionable. It's manageable, right? Yeah. If you can manage it, or, you know, it doesn't mean you have to master it.
No. And people have asked me, like, well, how do you work with a vet or veterans that are going through this? I said, talking to them.
Yeah.
Talking about these topics specifically exactly. So that they're thinking about it and then taking steps to address it.
Oh, man. All right. So cruising along here. So you got your first taste of the work that Pat was doing.
Yeah.
What is Pat Scannon? Who is Pat to you?
Oh man.
I
don't know if anybody's ever asked me that question. I've thought about it many times.
Real quick for the listeners, you can learn about Pat on the Project Recover website.
Yeah.
But he seems like an incredibly amazing individual just from an intellectual standpoint. I mean, he has a PhD in organic chemistry, correct? Mm-hmm. I read. And then he's a medical doctor. And I think he has trainings in internal medicine, which is not easy. So, I mean, he's definitely firing on all cylinders between the ears.
Yep.
But needless to say, it sounds like he just had a personal conviction to start this line of work with really no expertise and has just started doing it one day.
Yeah. His expertise was the scientific process.
Yeah.
And he started applying that to the research he was doing.
Yeah.
And, what happened was he was in Palau on a different mission. They were searching for a Japanese trawler that was sunk by George Herbert Walker Bush when he was an ensign. They found it. And then he had this extra time and he asked a guide to take him and his wife to World War II wreckage. And then, the guide took him to this B-24 wing that was in shallow water. And Pat asked what happened to the aircraft and what happened to the crew. And,
yeah.
And the guy didn't have any answers. And so Pat took it upon himself to start finding those answers.
Yeah.
And then realized the losses that took place and wanted to find out more what happened to these service members that were lost, and then just started doing missions himself.
Yeah.
Through his own initiative, and then realized, okay, I probably should be bringing a team together of like-minded folks to start focusing on this work. And that was the genesis of it. And now, you know, we went from doing one mission a year to Palau, all self-funded, and working in the jungles and working in the waters, to having some significant success and then partnering with others and growing our capacity. And now doing multiple missions a year all around the world. We've been to 21 different countries doing full recovery operations, undersea searches, all sorts of different things. But to Pat is,
Is he to you?
Yeah. So, well, he's many things to me.
Yeah.
I mean, he's one of my dearest friends. He's a mentor. He's a father figure. He's a leader. Somebody that I trust probably most in this world.
Yeah.
And one of the smartest people I know, I think one of the smartest people many people know. And it kind of to that point where it's like, okay, you have the capacity to do all these incredible things, which you do. And then you also somehow find more time to apply that expertise in this area and grow this capacity and become passionate. And so, but then he has this, energy or just demeanor that he's one of the people that you want just to be close to. Right. Pat and I have a very, very strong relationship, but I still remember like calling him and always like, wow, he answers the phone when I call. This is so cool that this person of this level is, somebody that's close to me. And I think a lot of people, feel that way. And that's not unusual. I think people of significance, we always kind of want to, you want to do one of two things. You either want to be close to them or find some way to tear them down, which is, it just seems like part of the human psyche. But I don't see too many people really going after him, but there's definitely a lot of people that want to be like close to him.
Yeah.
And he has this personality and energy too that draw that in.
Yeah.
And and it's difficult to put into words, but yeah, he is one of the most special people in my life. And, he's given so much to me, not only through Project Recover and my ability to, now lead this organization, but also just in several lanes of my life. He's just an incredible human being and, somebody that I cherish.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's good, man. I'm disappointed I'm not going to get to meet him on Thursday.
I wish you could.
Yeah. I do too. I really do as well. Let's talk a little bit about the promise that America makes to her service members who don't return home. Because that's a big kind of underlying foundational pillar of Project Recover.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we believe, and it's true, that when any individual, you know, swears an oath to our Constitution and dons a cloth of our nation, that we as a collective make a promise to that individual and their family that should they fall in battle, that we'll do everything that we can to bring them home. And so that's a promise, and that promise doesn't have an expiration date on it. And right now there's more than 80,000 Americans that are missing in action. That promise still needs to be kept. And, that's something that Project Recover acknowledges, and we're doing what we can to keep that promise, to those families and that individual. And, you know, and this work has an incredible impact on people, And one of the things that we're most proud of is the people tasked with keeping that promise tend to be the active service members serving alongside of the brothers and sisters in arms. And the context of war, sometimes means that that promise is delayed in its keeping. But the people that carry the weight of that are those service members as well as those families. And so it's incredible to witness the impact that this work has on people and communities. You know, so it's not obvious to a lot of people. To a lot of people, they ask us, you know, why is this work so important? Does anybody really care anymore? Especially if somebody's been missing for 8 decades or something like that. And the answer is yes, it's very important.
Yeah.
And it has an incredible impact.
Real quick, Derek, I apologize to interrupt, but I want people to understand, because I don't know if we've been clear about exactly what the mission is of Project Recover.
Yeah.
So explain that really quick.
Yeah. So Project Recover, the organization, is committed to locating and ultimately repatriating Americans missing in action from our previous wars. And we do everything from researching the archives, conducting interviews, researching all sorts of different means, and gathering information to execute search missions. And we search the, you know, jungles and waters around the world, looking for sites associated with MIAs, documenting those sites. And then now we're executing recovery missions to recover remains and artifacts associated with those that are missing to repatriate them back to the United States. And the only thing that we don't do in that process is the identification process, the official identification process. That's done blindly in a lab in either Hawaii or Nebraska, and restricted through Title 10 to be conducted by the Defense POW MIA County Agency. But we partner with DPA, as they're referred to. So we do unilateral work, and we do partner work with the Department of Defense. And the entire intention of that is to provide answers to Gold Star families of those that have lost their loved one and made the ultimate sacrifice. And yeah, so it's... we've been around now for 29 years.
That's amazing,
capacity.
Man.
Yeah, I've been involved in it now for almost 18 years. And
how many MIAs has Project Recover helped repatriate?
So we've been really ramping up things in recent years. So right now the number sits above 200 of sites we've located, identified, documented. Of those 200, 70 have been declared buried at sea.
Okay.
So the Navy made the decision that they're deep and they will not be disturbed, and Navy tradition deems that they'll remain where they lie. 15 have been repatriated, and then more than 100 are still open cases in some capacity. So the site's been located. We need to do more work on it. Remains or osseous material has been recovered. They're in a lab in some identification process or anything in between. So there's the sites have been located or at least documented, and then or they're all the way up to the identification sites our side. And we keep on building on that number almost faster than the identifications can take place and things like that. So,
and then you have teams of people that volunteer, mostly still volunteer.
Yeah, primarily a volunteer organization
that will then get organized and go to these locations and get to work in terms of
so
whatever it takes to get those remains back.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Project Recover, the nonprofit side of it is primarily volunteer based. And then, so people commit their time, their energies, their expertise.
I want to go on one. Yeah.
And then we have partners like at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the University of Delaware that contribute as well. So they can come out with their automated underwater vehicles that really, enhance these missions, as you can imagine.
Because when you guys first started, it was a lot of just like, let's go scuba diving, huh?
Scuba diving, getting online in the jungle with a machete and a compass and a GPS.
Yeah. Now it looks like a National Geographic expedition with some of the stuff that you're using to find the wreckages of these planes.
It's I mean, I'm always shocked by some of the people that we work with, but some of the most amazing minds in the world when it comes to some of the science and technology that we're working on, people that have just found out what we're doing and then realize that it's a worthy cause that they want to invest in. And so that's allowed us to obviously significantly scale our capability around the world, but it also allows us to contribute to the development of technology. So they can use these technologies to execute real world missions, further develop those technologies to be applied in all sorts of different capacities outside of an MIA mission as well. And then to add on to that, we are very much committed to education of the community and the next generation. Yeah. So we use these stories to work with youth, various levels, high school students, college students, all sorts. And, you know, not only tell them about the sacrifice made by these men and women that paid the ultimate price, but then keep those stories alive and then bring them into the mission so that then this work continues. You know, we talked about getting older, and apparently I'm getting older. That's what my doctor keeps on telling me. But somebody has to come in and fill the shoes when we can no longer traipse the jungles or swim the waters around the world.
It's phenomenal, man. So the movie that Project Recover recently released in December, the title is To What Remains. It's a documentary highlighting several stories about those that paid the ultimate sacrifice and those whose mission it has become to keep America's promise to her service members who didn't return home. I watched it. You gave me the code to get that the other day, and it's, I think you guys are airing it, or not airing it, but it's premiering downtown at the Tower Theater this Thursday, January 20th.
That's correct. Yeah. 7:30.
Yeah. I'm going to try to have this podcast out before then. Cause anybody that gets the opportunity to watch this movie absolutely should. It's an amazing documentary. I was struck by, and you were starting to mention this before I interrupted you, but the theme of closure, mm-hmm. that this work allows families and communities to kind of experience and then grow from is, yeah. And I think you were hinting to this earlier, but it's almost like the last thing you would expect in a way.
Yeah. You can't accurately put into words the impact, but it's, I mean, I cherish the moments that I had to witness it. And also, I mean, it gives me purpose and yeah. meaning in life being a part of this organization. But, yeah, people, you know, sometimes I think, you know, why are you doing this? Does anybody care? And they do. And that grief, and kind of void in the loss of this individual has passed from generation to generation. And we've interacted with many families that, you know, anybody that knew that person firsthand has since passed, but they all have these stories and it's a mythical figure.
Yeah.
And now you come in and say, well, here's the facts. We know where this person's at, or they're on their way home, or they're home. Sometimes they don't find out until they've been repatriated and they didn't even know anybody was looking.
Yeah.
And, you know, many times the initial response is, you know, what are you trying to sell me? What kind of scam is this? And I think that's part of the grieving process, as well. Huh. And then once they realize that we're not asking for anything, that we're just providing these answers and, it's our way of saying thank you. Then, many times they've invited us to participate in the memorial and celebration of their loved ones. And it's not about us. We really just try and become one with the wall and observe. And, but it's incredible to witness because you see those individuals impacted within the families and the service members, but then the communities come together in ways that I've never seen before, whether it's lining the streets, you know, kids getting let out of school in Portage, Pennsylvania on a cold November rainy day and just lining the streets to welcome an MIA home and show their appreciation for the sacrifice. Or, you know, that families coming together that people that they haven't even met before, even they're related by blood, they've never met and they're coming from every corner of the nation to honor their family member that's now home. And then of course that national level, now that's promises kept that we discussed yeah. earlier and trust is built and yeah, it's completely positive. There's nothing partisan about it. Everybody believes that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible way and an incredible thing to witness where people come together and connect instead yeah. of dividing. And
good for you guys, yeah. man. I was shocked with the numbers. You know, you referenced over 80,000 MIA and from conflicts was that from World War II up until Desert Storm?
Correct.
Yeah. The vast majority of those, World War II,
over 70,000. Yeah.
The vast majority of those, I mean, most of what your work that, I've been privy to read or see video of tends to be in the South Pacific. Do you guys operate in other areas of the world as well?
Yeah, we operate all over the world. Yeah. So the work started in the South Pacific, and there was a significant amount of losses there. But we're also in Europe. We've actually done mission to Kuwait.
No kidding.
Yeah, later on this year, I'll be in the Baltic.
Wow.
As well as the South Pacific. So we, now we've been to 21 different countries all over the world. We do work in the United States, so not included in that 80,000 plus number are training losses of people that are missing. Because of the context of their loss, they're not always designated MIA, but they're still missing. Their families miss them just as much as whether they were lost in combat. And so we put effort into trying to find some of those that were lost on our own soil or our own waters in training losses to bring them home as well. And so, yeah, we've been all over the world. It started, you know, as one mission a year in the nation of Palau in the South Pacific, but now multiple missions a year all over the world.
And people can learn about this projectrecover.org.
Correct.
Yeah. And from what it seems like, I mean, if there's a will, there's a way. I mean, you guys still are seeking active volunteerism.
Yes. So a volunteer base. So we're always looking for people that can expand our mission and contribute. And sometimes that's having the time available and the resources available to volunteer is very important. Sometimes it can take us some time to get back to people, but we will get back to them. We've been getting a lot of attention with the release of this film.
I bet.
And so we're excited to see how that can add to our mission. And yes, the film's showing here in Bend, and I'm really, really excited to share the work with the Central Oregon community. But if people can't make it, they can find more information on the film on our website as well.
All right. Good deal. Derek Abbey, how do you want people to remember you, buddy?
I don't know. I guess just, I think I just want to be remembered as somebody that you know, contributed, that hopefully this world is left in some better capacity because of my existence and not for the worse. And I'm just going to try and continue to build on that. You know, I've had experiences in my life, really through my combat experiences that I've come to terms that if I was hit by a bus tomorrow, I'm fine. You know, I did enough, but doesn't mean I'm going to stop. And so I just kind of keep on looking for ways of giving back, and giving my appreciation and gratitude for the luxuries that I have in this world.
Yeah. Well said, my friend. You've been described by your peers as, being able to develop rapport with the best of them, and very artful in the execution of your leadership style, which I think those are really high compliments, man.
Those are high compliments.
Anything that we didn't talk about, man, that you think would be worth mentioning?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I have more to offer people.
Job.
They've been listening for a while.
I know. Sorry if we bounced around everybody.
But we can talk about anything. Yeah. We can talk about hiking. And
I know. We can do that.
Part two, for sure.
We'll have to, I'm going to get you a split board.
Oh yeah. That's what I need to get into.
Yeah. You're going to love it. It's going to be right up your alley.
Heck yeah.
I started, and I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit this, but I don't really care. I started rucking after reading, The Comfort Crisis.
You shouldn't be embarrassed. I started rucking and I used to be in the military.
It is I did 3.5 miles this morning with 50 pounds.
All right.
And it was like, and I'm pretty fit. I do a lot of outdoor activities that keep me in decent shape, but man, there, you can see all, what I love about that book is they break down the science of why it's good for you.
Yeah.
And
less injury.
And,
you can just change your weight around.
Totally.
Get out and move around. So yeah, I mean, a little bit about me, like I used to not ruck because I'm like, if I'm going to carry weight and go somewhere, I better have that weight should have a purpose. Yeah. Like I'm backpacking to a campsite and I have a tent and food and things like that. And I had just kind of the negative thoughts of rucking associated with the military, which is a lot of heavy weight, a lot of time on your feet and things like that. And so I was like, I don't really have enjoyable experiences when I think back about that. But now I do, I enjoy it. And I'll mix up my running training where I'll take a day and I'll just throw a little bit of weight. It doesn't need to be a lot.
Right.
I'll throw a little bit of weight and I'll just go hike. And the cool thing about it is you're going slower, so you can kind of take in more around you, and you can change the weight to whatever you want. You don't even need to put weight on. You can just go hike. And I like, because the injury side of things is a lot less.
I would agree. I mean, from that's what I do for a living, and I can, it's just a much more controlled, you know, kinetic.
My wife and I just signed up for the Mount Hood 50 this morning.
Oh, you did?
So an ultra marathon, which means I'm going to have some tweaks and injuries here in my future as I work up training for that.
What else do you do besides run? Do you cycle?
I mean, I do everything.
You like it all.
I do cycle, but I wouldn't use the label of cyclist or anything like that. But I go to the gym, I ruck, I hike, snowshoe, snowboard.
Yeah.
I really do. I mean, paddle when the weather's good. I really just kind of try and do anything I can to get outside. And I love to do stuff outside.
Yeah.
I love, that's why I live in Bend.
Yeah.
And my wife and I, that's part of our collective identity, is our appreciation of nature and spending time in the outdoors. And, we live here because anything and everything we want to do is within 10 minutes.
I know. So. We're very blessed, man. We take it for granted every single day. I tell my kids that every day. And the sad part is they will never understand it until they move away.
I have a really good friend from Oregon State who's still in the Navy, and he lives where I used to live in Washington, and then I live where he grew up.
No kidding.
And I wanted to get him here because he's part of Project Recover, too.
Oh, he is.
So he is another MD, and he's a dive medical officer.
Oh,
his
name is
Michaela Johnson. He went to Bend High School.
No way.
And he's still in the Navy. He's a Navy captain. Him and I met at Oregon State. He was in the Navy. I was in the Marine Corps, similar commissioning programs. And I really wanted him to be here for the screening just to show this additional Bend connection.
For sure.
And he's taking his girls to Disney World. So I'm like, come on, it's on the way. But no, it's another incredible human being and somebody.
Well, you've surrounded yourself with a lot of incredible people, man. I feel privileged to get to meet you. Thank you for your time, man. I look forward to a new friendship and get out and get outside together and do this.
I love it.
All right, man. Thanks again,
Derek.
Thank
you for having me.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Circling Podcast. Our theme song was written by Carl Perkins and performed by Aaron Kohlbaker and Dr. Aaron Zerflew. We love mail, so please send us comments and questions to thecirclingpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on Instagram @thecirclingpodcast to learn more about past, current, and upcoming episodes. Please subscribe to The Circling Podcast on most major podcast platforms and leave us a review. It really does help. If you're interested in learning more about Project Recover or how you can help support their efforts, or you would like to view their newly released documentary, To What Remains, visit them online at projectrecover.org. Lastly, if you know someone who you think would enjoy today's episode, please share it with them today. Thanks for your time, Central Oregon. Get outside. We'll see you out there. And remember, the health of our community relies on us. Bend Magazine's A Circling Podcast is proud to be in collaboration with Story Booth. Story Booth is designed to redefine the experience of creating, remembering, and sharing the meaningful moments in life. Story Booth exists to take advantage of the moment by creating a shared storytelling experience. Visit storyboothexperience.com to learn more and see how Story Booth makes fun weddings more fun and lame weddings less lame.